Donald, congratulations. What a beautiful first half.
Oh, well, thank you. I shouldn't take the credit. It's this great, great orchestra.
The Fantasia on a Theme of Thomas Tallis, which opened the program, it's a very lyrical, expansive work. What do you think drew Vaughan Williams in the 20th century to this particular theme, which Tallis wrote in the 1500s?
Thomas Tallis, one of the greatest and least known English composers, yes. He lived and worked primarily in London at the beginning of the 16th century. Vaughan Williams was always fascinated from a young age with folk tunes and with melodies in melodies from the land, And he went on long trips where he basically collected tunes. And he was given the commission, actually, then to provide a lot of themes for hymns to be put into what is known as the English hymnal for the church. And this is what he indeed did. And in collecting them, there were just various hymn tunes that he came across, or in the case of Thomas Tallis, that haunted him. And I feel that this theme lent itself so much to the sound world he wanted to create, this feeling of, the work was written, 1909? Remarkable when you think it was the same year that Mahler was writing his Ninth Symphony, two very different sound worlds. But he clearly thought about this piece in a physical space. This was music to be performed in a large cathedral. This is a piece in which there are basically three orchestras. There is the main orchestra, there's a smaller orchestra which should be placed at a distant point. This feeling of you're sitting in the audience and there's a sound coming from somewhere, but you're not quite sure where it is. Is it from the organ loft? Is it from the back of the nave? And of course, there's the solo quartet.
Are you able to achieve that cathedral-like sound in a regular concert hall?
It takes a bit of work. I mean, we positioned the orchestra and we had a couple of options. Above all, to place this orchestra in a distant place or more distant than the main orchestra. And I think, yes, it is always a challenge in concert halls, depending on how deep your stage is. But I think we found a good option. Well, I hope you feel we found a good option.
Absolutely. And then you move to the Mozart Prague Symphony, which is just a miracle of operatic color and character. What does a conductor need to do or not do to bring this music to life?
A conductor should not get in the way. It's supremely vocal. It's supremely lyrical music. Specifically, the symphony, I feel, is very much informed by the world of Don Giovanni, as I told the orchestra working on it. This is a precursor of the Requiem. For all the buoyancy and the joy and the energy, there are these moments where all of a sudden it's like a cloud. Suddenly a dark cloud moves over the sun and you are, for a few bars, suddenly drawn into a far darker, far more ominous world. And then the sun shines again and you're in this miraculous sound world. And so as a conductor, I think you are working with the orchestra, not so much working with them in terms of getting them to play it well. I mean, this is a banquet of riches here with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Their virtuosity is astonishing. I find myself talking a lot about sound worlds. I find myself talking about a potential narrative in this music.
In a few minutes, you'll be stepping on stage to conduct the second half of your program, which begins with an orchestral suite drawn from Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel. You're conducting the opera itself at the Met this season. What do you find to be Humperdinck's special gift in either version?
His phenomenal talent with melodies. And of course, we know that Humperdinck was a huge fan of Richard Wagner. He played indeed in the orchestra at Bayreuth, where the Wagner Festival happens every year. And he played with the master. He played with Richard Wagner. And of course, his music, his sound world is enormously informed by Richard Wagner. But some people actually talk about it, Hansel and Gretel, as being Wagner's best opera. because it's short, it's concise, it's beautiful, it has a happy ending. But really, his phenomenal ability to create this fantasy world for the children, to create this the pantomime, this sequence where the children are indeed dreaming, and you can hear in the music, you can quite literally hear where they fall asleep. Mm. And you can hear where they move from their natural world into this dream world. And with all the colors available to Humperdinck, he creates this masterful score, which is, as I say, very concise. And what has been a thrill this week, I wasn't really aware of it when we programmed this, how little the orchestra has actually played mm-hmm. this music. And I've been enormously touched and quite moved by how many of the players have actually come up to me and said, thank you for programming this piece. We don't do this enough, and this is gorgeous. Where has it been all my life? And that's where, as a musician, as a conductor, those are moments that really mean the world to you.
That must be so gratifying. You'll end the program with an overture. Normally, overtures begin programs. Tell me about ending with an overture.
In the context of this and these four pieces, the question became, what do you follow this suite with, this Engelbert Humperdinck, the Hansel and Gretel? And I thought that this would be a moment to bring one of the great, great overtures of Richard Wagner. Because, of course, as I say, it's his sound world is very much Humperdinck's world, and Richard Wagner was something of a mentor. And it was actually when I was on tour with the orchestra in China a few years ago that we first programmed this piece and put it as an ending, and it works wonderfully. I mean, of course, it is the beginning of the opera, but at the same time, the music comes at the end of the opera too, and you only have 4 hours between. In other words, the music it isn't just an introduction to Tannhäuser; it is at the same time a peroration. It's the climax of the work. The music that we hear, this great pilgrim's chorus, this great theme, we hear quite quietly and piously from the woodwinds at the beginning. We hear at the very end where the brass, where the trombones, where it's almost, it's trumpeted out. And this is indeed exactly how the opera ends, except it's with the chorus singing it. The orchestra plays it gloriously, and I think it's a fitting end.
And it's almost as if that final chord invites the audience to keep hearing the music in their minds.
It does, and of course the Vaughan Williams ends so quietly and so beautifully. In some ways, applause is a little foreign to the experience. And of course the Humperdinck also ends very quietly and very touchingly. And it's good at the very end of this journey to end with, well, I mean, more than ever, we need hope and humanity, don't we? We need something happy. We need a happy ending. We need to be reminded through music, and that's why this has never worked for me. This is a joy and a privilege to be conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I feel that when you hear music like this, you're reminded just of the beauty and the incredible abilities of human beings, of how they can really create a beautiful world, live in a beautiful world, but through their music create another world that touches each and every one of us. And I think more than ever at the moment, we're all very much in need of nutrition, some spiritual nutrition.
You conduct with a baton in your left hand, and I've heard that you've said, because you began your career in Great Britain and you're Scotsman, that nobody made a big deal out of it from where you started. But if you had trained in Germany, for instance, you may have been forced to conduct with your right hand. Is there anything else about being from Scotland, beginning your career in the British Isles, that lends you a different sensibility or approach to conducting than you might have had you started in America or on the continent?
I'm something of autodidact, in that I never had formal training as a conductor. And yes, indeed, I think if I had, as a student, gone to Germany to learn the trade of conducting, I might have been forced to conduct with my right hand. In terms of do I bring anything else to my music because I'm from that part of the world, I think I bring an inferiority complex. I think that the Brits are quite famous for the feeling of, certainly in the arts, Europe is where the professionals are, and you have this nagging, am I good enough, am I good enough? I mean, every time I come here, and I'm thrilled to have this relationship, but each and every time, and it never gets less so, there's a feeling of, am I good enough for this orchestra? Is what I bring to them, will that be enough? And I, really, this is not some kind of false immodesty. It is what I feel. And then when I'm actually up there, I think, wow, this is working. This is fun. This is fun. But I only bring that up because I think, I hope that genuine humility also comes across in what I do. But otherwise, I've always been very heartened and enormously supported by the feeling that it doesn't really matter where you come from. I'm just very, very fortunate and very privileged to work with many orchestras and many opera companies. And I have to say, though, one of my favorite orchestras is indeed this great orchestra. It doesn't get better than this.
Well, it was a joy to speak with you, Donald Runicles. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.